In the new book, Rooted, cutting-edge science supports a truth that poets, artists, mystics, and Earth-based cultures across the world have proclaimed over millennia. Life on this planet is radically interconnected. Our bodies, thoughts, minds, and spirit are affected by the whole of nature, and they affect this whole in return. Now, award-winning writer Leanda Lynn Haupt has written a new book, which is an invitation to live with the Earth in both simple and profound ways, from walking barefoot in the woods and reimagining our relationship with animals and trees to examining the very language we use to describe and think about nature. The name of the book is Rooted, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Leanda Lynn Haupt to the roundtable this morning. Leanda, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much.
When I open up the front jacket of the book, there is a comment that says, a beautifully written manifesto for our complex time. Rooted inspires readers to deepen their connection with nature in unexpected ways and to act powerfully on the Earth's behalf. I respect anyone who writes a manifesto. Did you think of it in those terms as you began?
We struggled with that word a little bit, whether to put that in or not. And, you know, as I continued to write the book, I thought, wow, more than any other book I've written, I am writing what I just really want to say and what I really believe and what I think is important to hear right now. And I thought, it's starting to sound like a manifesto. And then I thought, you know, the manifesto is one of the great literary devices in our history. And so I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to embrace it. And so we did choose that word consciously, and I really stand behind it, and I love it.
So ultimately, you want to tell us, because this is an invitation, if you will, of how we can live with the Earth. So talk to us beyond the idea of a manifesto, of the mission statement of the book, of what you wanted to ultimately accomplish. You said you wanted to say, like, I'm writing what I really want to say here. What is it that you really wanted to say?
Right. You know, honestly, the inklings of this book at the very beginning came from the science and then the trend of forest bathing in this country. So just a little refresher, we've all heard about forest bathing. It began in Japan when therapists and some other healthcare practitioners started actually prescribing time in nature to their patients and clients who were stressed and anxious or who had other diseases. And they say, take 20 minutes to walk in nature and it will help you. And the heavy science people came in and said, you know, we really need evidence-based research if we're going to be prescribing these things. And so that research started in Japan, and there's rafts of it now that shows that when we do spend time in nature, our heart rate goes down, our stress-producing cortisol goes down, our blood pressure goes down, the balance of the activity in hemoglobin in our prefrontal cortex of our brain that contributes to many things, including emotional well-being, but also creativity, all of that comes into balance. And so what happened is that once the research of forest bathing called Shinjin Yoku in Japan hit the United States, we started doing what we do best in the U.S., which is making it into a business, right? Where people could become certified in being forest guides and you could pay to go on forest therapy walks. And I thought, you know, this is lovely. It's wonderful that there is science that affirms that our deepest health and our heartiest well-being comes from our connection to the natural world. But there was a but for me in that. And the but was that we already knew this. You know, we knew this long before the science. The science is beautiful and it's affirming, but poets, artists, Earth-based indigenous cultures, children have been showing us these same things for millennia. And so what I really wanted to say in this book is that there's a way that this new science honors an innate knowing of our continuity with the wild earth. And I think that when we meet at that crossroads of science and nature and our innate intelligence, our innate natural and wild intelligence, that we have something really beautiful and powerful. And so that's the intersection that I wanted to celebrate and explore in this book.
Early in the book, you write about the tenets of rootedness. And this is an entire chapter, so I don't expect you to do a summary of the entire chapter. But give us a sense of some of the tenets of rootedness.
Okay. Well, one of them is what I call everyday mysticism. And I think mysticism is a word that can get kind of woo. And I want to point out that although I use the word spirit in this book, it's very expansive. It doesn't have to do with religion. If you're religious or not religious, this book is still for you. Spirit refers to those aspects of our minds like creativity and imagination that are difficult to measure in the traditional ways and statistical ways, but they are part of our beautiful human intelligence. And so I use mysticism, again, very expansively to mean comprehension or apprehension of our sense of oneness with the natural world, of our deep interconnection with the natural world, the kind that science is finding. So ecology has been a science that's been around for a while that affirms that same thing, that, you know, if you've ever gone to nature camp, you've played this game where they take a ball of yarn and they give it to one person who's the sun, who represents the sun, and pass it to a person who represents the trees and one who represents the rivers and blah, blah, blah. So we're all connected by this piece of yarn. And then in the game, one person drops their piece of yarn and the whole thing collapses, right?
Right.
So we learn over and over again in different ways about the depth of our interconnection and the significance of our actions in our lives and our households. So by saying ecology and mysticism come together, that's one of the tenets. I'm just saying that beautiful idea that has been around in spirituality, this sort of mystical oneness, and in science of ecology oneness are so similar, and they mutually reinforce one another. So that's one example of one of the tenets. Is there one that particularly interests you that you'd like to talk about?
Yes, absolutely. And it's eccentricity, and it's probably because I've been called eccentric my entire life. But you write, "To live rooted on a changing earth is to create a new story. There are very few voices left that speak for wild nature first. It's time to clasp hands, paws, fins, feathers, branches, and know where we stand. The ways of this story will not appear conventional within outworn cultural norms. Our new ways are disruptive. They will look weird. This is good. Let us not care, but enjoy the glimpse in another's eyes that we will find sometimes, the one that says, 'You're not crazy. I feel it too.'" What a wonderful way of expressing that.
Thank you so much for reading it. You read it better than I could. And you know, I mean, some of the things that I suggest that, you know, sometimes we shed our shoes if we are able and put our feet on the earth, that we don't just walk past a tree and think, oh, it's pretty, but that we lean into it with our face and maybe put our arms around it. Like beloved Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh recommends that when we hug a tree, it benefits both our own sense of calm and intelligence and peace, but that it may affect the tree beneficially as well. And from what we're learning about the consciousness of trees and all of the new research that's happening, that's absolutely possible. And so I suggest, yeah, take off your shoes sometimes, hug a tree sometimes. If someone sees you and thinks you're weird, what's wrong with that? We are creating a new story. And I feel that we're sort of trapped sometimes in this normalcy. Even though we know that we are at our most authentic when we step outside of those norms. And so I just want to press this a little bit, not to, you know, leave our shoes at home and go into the office barefoot and injure our feet by hiking, you know, high heels with backpacks on, but just say, you know, we don't have to be normal. And it's beautiful not to be sometimes. And we can look at one another and inspire one another to live more wildly and imaginatively and in ways that benefit both ourselves and the earth in this time.
One of the chapters of the book that really, or sections of the book that really struck me was when you write about solitude, and it's called Alone, mm-hmm. the Essential Complexity of Solitude. And you cite studies that find that 85% of us are craving time alone. I think that probably happens, and most of us don't even realize it, of how much mm-hmm. we crave that.
I think that's true. And then, you know, I think one of the next lines is in the book is that it's also something, it's one of the things that we fear the most.
Right. We don't want to be alone because we don't know how we occupy that time.
Right. And I want to say, I know this is a little bit cliche at the moment, but our technology has a lot to do with that. I think it's really hard until we leave our phones aside for a day or a couple of days or more we don't even recognize how dependent we've become on just picking that up and pressing that button and checking the thing. And it's so reflexive, and I find it in myself. I don't want to sound like I'm misenlightened about my phone use. I'm not. But we do need to set our technology aside in order to experience at times the fullness of our minds and the potential of our minds. One of the things that happens when we're alone is that we give up what I love this. Psychologists call this the spotlight effect. And we all know this when we're in a room and we say something and we think that everyone is focusing on what we say, or everyone is noticing that our palms are sweaty or that we're a little nervous, or right. when in fact, no one's noticing us, right? We're just worried about thinking that everyone's noticing them. So when we are in solitude, we are able to let that fall away. And so we get to a deeper sense of self. And the other thing that I want to say about the phone is it's so funny. There have been these studies that show that when the phone beeps, our bodies have the same reaction in terms of our fight or flight reaction that we would have if we heard the growl of a large predator, like a bear, right. behind us. So every time the phone dings, our bodies just freak out. And so in solitude, although we might actually be worried about bears, at least we don't have this phone dinging over and over and pressing us into this stress state. So that's interesting. And the other thing, I want to be really honest and say in my solitude chapter, one of the things I talk about is that when I go away for days at a time, and when it becomes nighttime, I get really scared. I freak myself out. And that is important too. I think it's meaningful to just sort of settle into our complexity.
Do you know what you're scared of?
You know, no. Yes and no. I say no because I think most of the things are just in my imagination, but I can name them when I'm alone in the dark. I'm afraid of bad men coming into my space somehow.
Right.
And that's mainly it. And then I just, every little, you know, noise that I hear outside becomes something really large. And then I'll wake up and emerge into a beautiful morning. And I think, oh my gosh, what happened to my brain last night? But I do think that this is something that humans have been doing for millennia. We've been going into solitude, into wilderness, looking for a deeper sense of vision. And it's something that is rare today, but I think is worth revisiting.
Leanda Lynn Haupt is the author of the new book, Rooted: Life at the Crossroads of Science, Nature, and Spirit. In talking about the solitude, and you mentioned fight or flight a moment ago, I know in the treatment of my anxiety, one of the things that my therapist said was, well, okay, when you start to become short-circuited is when you're dealing with unscripted time. So...
Mm-hmm.
What is wrong with scripting being alone? of scripting time just for you. What's wrong with saying, okay, I'm going to put this time where I'm going to take a walk, I'm going to do this. And that's really part of it too, isn't it? That not to be a slave to anything, but to allow yourself that moment away or moments away. I like what you just said of days. That sounds nice. I haven't mm-hmm. done that, but that does sound nice.
Right. I think you're coming to an interesting paradox where we're sort of carving out time and putting time on our schedule to not have anything to do.
Right.
We're scripting unscripted time. I love that. I hadn't thought of it in that exact way before. And we do have to do that the way these days. We do have to do that the way that our schedules work. But I want to say something that's a little bit different from what most people say. I struggle with anxiety myself. And in this book, you can see that it's funny. Some of these sections or imperatives that I set up to structure the book can sound a little, they could walk that edge of being kind of woo-woo and out there. But if you read the book, you'll see that I'm really grounded in science. I really right. want things to be smart, right? And I want to honor our innate intelligence and our scientific intelligence and blend those together. So what I'm coming to here is something that I haven't been able to find in the science, but I find in myself, being an anxious person who loves to find solace in the natural world and in wandering and in unstructured time. In the science and in the psychology, we see that people talk about how when we're in nature, we have this sort of this quiet awareness, you know, that the leaves are moving sweetly and maybe the waves are kind of shushing a little bit and the breeze is fragrant, and all of these things invite this calm response in us, that our parasympathetic nervous system, the one that's in charge of us being less nervous, more peaceful, is activated. But for me, something really different happens when I go to the, and that happens too, and I love that. But I also, if I spend longer time in wilder places, I see that really what's going on there is anything but calm, you know? That everything from the tiniest fungus to, I live in the Pacific Northwest, to the 600-year-old red cedar, to the coyote, to the Cooper's hawk, or to the little migratory warbler. Everyone is worried about food and water and what they're going to eat next and whether they're going to be eaten, right? And so there's this constant sort of alertness and, in a sense, a wild anxiety that we are in continuity with. And for some reason, instead of making that feel more anxious, that makes me feel calm, because I think, oh my gosh, it's not just me. It's everything. We're just all in this together. It's complicated. It's beautiful. Sometimes it's sweet. Sometimes it's hard. And there we are in it.
You write, there is a beautiful chapter in here, it's called Unsee, and I'm just going to read a portion of this. It's from a section called Life at the Speed of Dark. Mm-hmm. I write against a backdrop of systemic racism leading to a level of civil unrest and protest unprecedented in my lifetime. Everyone from self-help gurus and meditation instructors to my own wise therapist suggests that we learn to be comfortable in discomfort. But is this the highest counsel? Buddhist eco-philosopher and activist Joanna Macy points out that in much of the spiritual teaching, grief and anger over current social and ecological conditions are then seen as attachments and judged to be less valuable than experiences of tranquility. And you write, but this, she says, is a spiritual trap. Instead, beauty and terror arise within us simultaneously. It is right that we are disoriented in these times. How could it be authentic? How could it authentically be otherwise? The word that struck me there is, as you say, instead, beauty and terror arise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're tapped into the terror. We may not be tapped into the beauty.
Okay. Yes. Especially in this time, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, that is why I really, in this book, want to recognize the depth of this complexity, to not oversimplify it by saying, oh, let's bring the light, you know, but to honor that these things, that as Joanna Macy said, beauty and terror arise together. This is a time when we have really swung the balance toward difficulty, toward anxiety. And so I think in this moment, it's a time to take a lot of the things I speak to in this book and find some comfort in. I mean, one of the things I talk about in this book is reciprocity, right? That when we walk with an attitude that is one of both giving and receiving in the earth, that upon the earth, out our doorsteps, among our neighbors,
right.
That's when we're acting, you know, from our highest self and purpose. But this is a time when we need to be good to ourselves, you know, and understand that it's okay. That we're scared. Of course we are. Yes, we're anxious. Of course we are. And so more than ever, to take this time to find the ways to connect with the natural world that will help bring that back into balance. One of the things that I talk about in this book is this idea of kiss-ship. In environmental ethics circles and circles where people are philosophizing about ecology, one of the big words right now is kinship.
Yeah.
That we are all related to all beings. Starts with other humans, extends to more than human creatures, and now is beginning to extend to the animal beings, or the plant, botanical beings, trees and other plants, and mycelia, fungus. And the word that I want to offer alongside that is the idea of kith. There's that English phrase, kith and kin, and in our minds, they've become conflated as if they're the same thing, but they're really not. There's a reason that they're two different words. Kin are relations, and kith is the land and the neighbors and all of the things that make up the places that we live, so that when we walk into the world, we think, oh, there's this tree, there's this neighbor, there's this house, this is where this raccoon has a den and where this robin nests. And I think that when we walk into the world with an attitude of coming to know what is our square mile, as UK philosopher Jay Griffiths puts it, that is when we become truly rooted in a place to know the things, the people, the beings around us, not by rote, but by heart, is what allows our deepest rootedness and the flourishing of those around us. That knowledge is what allows us to know how to act, who needs help and what needs help and how, and maybe how we need help in return.
It's a beautiful place to end our conversation. The name of the new book is Rooted: Life at the Crossroads of Science, Nature, and Spirit. The book is published by Little Brown. Leanda Lynn Hopta, thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. I so appreciate the conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Rooted. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.